creature, leading their two horses. When Sink's eyes adjusted to the gloom, the fat man had already stopped before three horses, next to one another in temporary wooden stalls. Before the fat man led out each horse, Sink was already certain these were his. The bay mare had a divot in her neck from an old arrow wound. No white markings. A remodeling splint on her right front cannon. The second was a red chestnut, with a scrape on her head where her white star should have been. Somebody'd skinned her there to hide the identifying mark. He touched her shoulder, ran his hand down to her left elbow. She had an old boil there. He treated it himself. The third horse was Ari's big brown gelding, a seasoned warhorse with too many scars to hide and a spavined left hock. The band had put out descriptions of all these horses through the garrison city guard. Ari's gelding should have white on its left hind hoof and ankle, but didn't. He bent down and rubbed hoof and hair backward, then licked his fingers and tried again, while the fat man rocked in place. Sink's hand came away with a brown stain on his fingers. He stood up and showed the horse dealer his fingers. "These are steps on horses."
"But you knew that, you porker."
"I traded for them in good faith," whined the fat man.
"Let's see the gear. Tell me what the man looked like. Who brought them in?"
"It wasn't a man. It was a young woman, or I thought it was."
The fat fellow brushed his nose with his knuckle and slid his eyes left and upward as a man does when he's lying.
"Tall, black hair, light blue eyes," said the horse trader innocently. "Said she got them in payment for a debt."
Stratton, the band's interrogator, would decide how innocent this fat man was later.
"What did you give for them?"
Here was the gear, slung over a half wall. No weapons, but the tack was steps on issue. Sink nearly stumbled over Arten close behind him when he turned around. The trainee looked as if he were about to burst with excitement. The fat man named a price. Sink offered half. "And that price includes the gear. No haggling. You're in receipt of stolen property. You don't want trouble with us, because trouble with us never, ever stops. You do this again, and I find out you're out of luck and out of business." Outside the tent, ponying the three horses of their dead comrades on leads with nearly all their tack, Sink said,
"Sweet work, stepson. What else can you do?"
Arten's eyes were shining like the sun. Molin Torchholder is eminently prepared for this meeting with Giscaris in the east wing of the palace, only a corridor away from the private chapel consecrated to the storm god Vashenka. No one from the Council of Oligarchs was here so early. Good. This was as he planned, just as he had planned to wear his simplest red and white robes and have his prettiest boy usher the stepson inside and then leave them. He wanted to be alone with Giscaris for this meeting. Sun is streaming in the library windows, pooling on the silk rugs, shining off the marble tiles. The tall oak doors open silently when the young stepson is brought in, staring boldly at all the wealth displayed on every wall and shelf and table. The doors close, just as silently, behind him. Molan says nothing, assessing this warfighter to be with the blood of a god running in his veins, or so legend has it. "You wanted to see me?" says the red-haired boy in his armor and his leathers and his linen. Green eyes like his mother's, broad shoulders, a firm and careful demeanor, looking all around with calculating eyes.
"Yes, I'm so pleased to see you here at last. Sit down, Giscareth."
Make a friendly face, but not too friendly. "Sit in this single chair before my desk as I have arranged it on this day when everything will change for you. Let me tell you of all the glory that awaits you. There's watered wine on the sideboard if you're thirsty."
The youth stands just within the threshold, helmet under his arm, at parade rest.
"No, thank you, Eminence. If you don't mind, I'll stand."
"But I do mind. We're going to have a conversation. I will sit at my desk. You will sit in that chair."
He indicates the chair sharply with his hand.
"Son of the storm god Vashenka, or son of the Riddler?"
Tempus had been the god's proxy during the ritual copulation that produced Giscaris. Neither god nor avatar takes direction well. It's too early to have a test of wills.
"You seem so very young for those eyes to be so appraising, your demeanor so composed."
The young stepson strides stiffly to the chair and takes his seat, helmet in his lap. He stares at Molan through a fighter's eyes, waiting to hear what is required of him.
"Do just what you're told and the known world can be yours. Ranky is falling away. Marbles turning to dust. Crumbling without a strong hand or a plan. Thank you, Giscaris."
Chorus.
"Pardon?"
"Mygdonia's too far north to threaten us, with Wizard Wall looming in between. We're a mighty city-state now, not a backwater. We have a navy.
We have rich trade routes, richer than a boy like you can dream."
"Everyone calls me Chorus."
This boy has a voice deeper than he'd first thought.
Husky and audacious. "No war name. Mine is Torch. The Basib invaders from the sea are gone. The Ilse gods still sleep their geriatric sleep, fuzzily trying to remember who and what they are. Such a ripe moment for the right man for fate to step in."
"No war name. Yet."
The youth tilts his head and peers harder at Molan.
"If I may be so bold, Eminence, what is this about?"
"Last time we met, you asked about your mother, Salala. You didn't ask about your father." "And what are you, warfighter? Are you the right man? Are you our future, or just another nail in our coffin?"
"That's right, I didn't. My mother's dead, you said."
"It was a ritual begetting. A rite performed for and with Vashenka, by his priesthood and by Tempus.
So long ago, when the gods fought here like cats and dogs and sorcery ran wild. This son of the storm god is steady, controlled. and even handsome in a pale and bloodless sort of way.
Bandaran training makes its initiates like icebergs.
Most of what matters is hidden below the waterline. So Molin must look deeper.
It's time you knew about your father. Time we know if you are really the son of the storm god, Vashanka's boy, and all our hopes reborn, or just another child of the hero cults.
I'm a stepson. In the Riddler's service, I've sworn the sacred band oath. I assure you, I know my father.
Giscarus's voice is sharper now, but his body and face hardly move. Only his green eyes flicker, more brightly colored than they were before. Sacred band? Do you have a partner? Are you paired?
Sitting quietly can be harder than running miles.
Molin lets his hands slide off the table lest the boy see quivering or perspiration or fingers twisting one another.
Not yet. It's not time.
Thank the god.
If you're all they say, you'll never will be paired. If Vashanka, our storm god, lurks behind those eyes, then you're just the one we need.
Eminence, what did you say?
Let me be frank.
Molin never is. He comes around his desk and sits on it, close enough to reach out and touch this boy, who stays so still, like a marble statue of a fighter, or a warrior priest, or a god.
Or am I seeing only what I hope to see, need to see, since sanctuary's gauze is so weak, so old, and, at this strange time, so disengaged?
If you are what people think you are, a true son of Vashanka, our long-missing storm god, then sanctuary's arms will open wide to welcome you.
All we have will be yours.
Giscarus gets up, puts his helmet under his arm, and looks Molin in the eye. They are barely an arm's length apart.
If, this isn't humorous to me, you brought me here to mock me. I have a bad temper compared to some. It gets out of hand sometimes. They say Vashanka is the berserker god, so beware.
Now there's blood in that face, hot flush in the cheeks, nostrils flaring white. Knuckles pale, grasping helmet with one hand, belt with the other.
Good, there's life in you. Maybe a god in you. Some real god with real power to replace the absent Stormbringer and a dozen lesser deities who never heed the sacrifices left for them on the street of temples. A god to help us.
Take our part.
Take mine. The wizard blood within me says it's so. Just give me a sign.
So beware. If you're truly the Storm God's son, I am your humble servant. Vashanka was our state cult here once, revered above all other gods. His name was on the palace dome once,
and could be again. Come with me, Giscarus. We need to prove just who and what you are.
You doubt me? My word? My heritage? Question me and my father, the god? Test me? Ask for proof at your peril, priest.
The boy is livid, holding on to his temper with every skill he has. Outside, distantly, lightning flickers and thunder rumbles. Molin turns his back on the young fighter. now with bloodlust and surging anger in his eyes, and walks to the wall of shelves where he pushes a shelf, and a passageway opens.
Will you come, Giscarus? Come test your fate, meet it, and if you're worthy, will you be all we need?
He hears the stepson behind him in the passageway that's nearly dark but for a square of light down at its end.
Tell me, Giscarus, Molin asks, taking a chance.
Hearing the footfalls of the angry young man closing up the distance between them.
Can you stop the rain? Start it? Bring a storm? Can you?
That's the only test you face, the only proof I need.
And if you can I get you away from that accursed Tempus and his sacred band?
Can I? I can start the rain, bring thunder, bring lightning, came a growl from nearly in his left ear.
Want to see? Oh, yes, I do.
Then the young stepson glimpses the statue of his father, the storm god, 4 cubits high. The statue of Vashenka crawls with sparks as outside the little palace chapel and all over sanctuary a fierce storm breaks, driving rain before it. Storm winds howl their fury, and lightning snarls from the east of heaven to the west, and thunder shakes the ground. Rain pelts down from heaven, and in the storm god's chapel Giscarus crosses his arms and stares defiantly at the priest, while lightning flares and thunder cracks and peals like chariot horses under the god's own whip running down the sky.
What say we let that fat horse trader run away home? Strat proposed, trying to get Crit's attention in their shambles cross Hidey Hole.
My shoulder hurts from pushing all that blubber up the stairs, and it's not easy hitting hard enough to make an impression through so much fat. Your hand just sinks in. If we kill him, we've got to dispose of the body, which means getting all that dead weight back down the stairs.
Because he's not going to fit through the window, so we can't just drop the corpse onto the street.
Critias, sitting under iron shutters tightly closed, just grunted. The table before him was overflowing with paperwork, confiscated drugs, truncheons, slingshots, and dirks. Behind Strat, in the other room, the horse trader moaned theatrically. Crit rolls a smoke, broadleaf laced with pulchus and kerf they'd taken from some locals. The privilege of command.
The fat man thinks it was a tall, pretty youth masquerading as a girl who sold him our horses. Sounds like sham to me.
Strat waits for Crit to respond. Nothing. The sword slice on Strat's thigh, a souvenir from Chironea, still itched. Strat scratched at it.
He's certain he doesn't know any more. I know that for a fact. Fatty will do us more good than a recruiting poster sporting all those miles of fresh bruises. Get us a little respect from those citizens who don't remember us from last time.
Around them, like familiar old clothes, was the Shambles Cross safe house, where Crit once kept an office and now did again. The iron shutters, like the rest of the place, were the worse for wear, but still good enough.
They took field reports here,
ran covert agents when they had them, and sometimes slept in shifts on a narrow bench that doubled as a couch. Strat poured cheap wine from a pitcher into chipped cups for both of them. Water here spilled your guts.
Say something before my prisoner dies of heart failure or old age or both. What? Maybe it was Shamshi who sold those horses to the trader. Maybe not,
Critias said absently.
What's the difference, unless the trader knows where the seller's gone or where he lives? Go ahead if you're satisfied. Let him run back home.
Preoccupied. Braving the reek of so much terrified flesh and loosened bowels, Strat went into the other room and freed the prisoner. Released, the ponderous trader pounded through both doorways and down the stairs.
"Hope those stairs hold under all that weight," Strat said, gazing after his subject before closing the door. "Now, left side leader, what's the trouble?"
Strat picked up his cup from the table, watching Crit over it.
"You're 100 miles away."
Crit doesn't say a word. He gets out his pouch where his flints are and his luck charms. He strikes a spark on a bit of parchment, lights 2 smokes, extinguishes the burning parchment with a loud slap from his palm, and gives 1 smoke to Strat. Then Crit says,
"Ace, maybe we have a problem." "Only one?" Strat says, nodding sagely. "That's a good day in Sanctuary."
But it isn't going to be just one problem. Strat knows that tone. Crit scoops up his luck charms and throws them. A personal divination rite he tries only when consternation overwhelms him. His single die lands with 1 dot up, half atop an old field star on a rotted ribbon. A little silver cavalryman falls atop that. His gold amulet of the storm god leans against the lead fighter.
Crit's shell and claw fishhook has its claw over the amulet.
Crit shakes his head, staring at his personal omina, pulling at the dirty bandage on his right arm.
"Tell me how this could be worse. The last time I saw 1 dot up, Ace, your damned ghost horse and I had to rescue you from that loft at Paris House just before it burned."
"Fancy that. Those trinkets may tell you something. They don't tell me a thing. I'll ask you a second time. What's wrong?"
Grith scoops up his charms, pockets them, and gets to his feet. He goes to the window and opens the iron shutters to the muggy night. They squeal, in need of oil.
"Rain stopped. Good thing. Every piece of gear I've got is moldy. You can imagine what the local crops are like."
Then he faces Strat.
"Ace, I have 6 reports of rapes and murders, the usual mischief, nothing special. Any of that could be Shamshi, or none of it. Nothing definite. The Riddler wants results."
"We trained Sham. He knows every tactic, technique, and procedure we use. We'll get him, Fox. It's not the whole of it. What's bothering you?"
"Ace..."
Crit turned to Strat and said, hands out, palms up, as if for fending something. "I know you'll not like this, but it's beyond my control." He dropped his hands to his sides. They slapped against his thighs. Crit hated anything beyond his control. Strat crossed his arms and waited for whatever would come next, knowing now he really wouldn't like it. "We're having a party," Grit said, his fine Cyrese face screwed up, raking a hand through his dark hair in frustration.
"A what?"
"A party. A fete. A celebration. Call it what you will. They call it
evening parade. I call it stupid."
"There's that. The Thebans want to throw a party to thank us for the rescue. Karen spoke to the Riddler and Stealth, and they've agreed. Team building. Molin Torchholder's heard about it somehow, and he's supplying women, musicians, and shellfish from the palace."
"You jest."
"Deadly serious." Crit sighed and puffed on his broadleaf until it underlit his face, making his mouth seem too cruel and his eyes too puffy. "And everyone who's anyone in this scabrous town is invited. Torchholder wants to introduce the Thebans and reintroduce us, so I'm told,
to polite society.
I think we're doing a pretty good job of introducing ourselves." Strat hugged himself. "He's bringing women, and he wants to introduce us to polite society? At the same time? Can I assume that you mean these aren't brothel women?" "This is a Theban event. We're doing it the Theban way."
"What's the Theban way?"
"We're finding that out as we go. So far, it's this way. You play games, you eat, you drink, there's music, and then they bring on the women. Not whores, or at least not all whores. Some temple virgins looking for a good start in life, and willing women, maybe fancy, maybe some dancers. That's all I know." "This is going to get very prickly very fast. What are we supposed to tell our sacred banders about dealing with these women? Or not dealing with them? One mistake could be as bad as the other." "I don't know yet. That's what I'm saying. I do know we've got to deal with..." Crit starts ticking off items on his fingers. "Invitations from our side. People who'll be offended if left out. Food. Drink, horses, prizes and weapons for the games, logistics, security, liaison with the city guard." Then adds, "Oh, I forgot, firewood. Lots and lots of firewood." He taps ashes from his broadleaf into his hand, crumbles them to make sure they aren't still burning, and scatters them on the floor. Strat repeats, "Firewood. Why firewood?" "Because we're doing it at the lighthouse spit where the jetty is, where their goddess appeared. We're going to make some big bonfires and cook all the food on the beach. Do everything there. They want to dance and sing and pretend they're back in Thebes."
"They're not. That's an indefensible position. Molin's in this. Let's do it at the nice, safe-walled palace."
Strat's mouth goes dry. "Defending ourselves doesn't worry me as much as spending an evening outside on the lighthouse spit near Vashanka's Rip with a bunch of drunken townies and Thebans. Sure as the gods make kings of fools, some drunk will fall off that jetty and get swept out to sea by the riptide there. And it'll be our fault," Crit says glumly, "if nothing worse happens." Strat blows smoke out of his nostrils and says, "That worse is Shamshi for one thing, and me and Ashard for the other, in your estimation.
I can understand that you're worried about Shamshi showing up. A public event will draw him out.
So let's use it. Lay our own trap for him.
That's my thought, too. I could use a little help with planning. As for you and the witch, I didn't say anything. You did.
Strat mutters.
Going to be too damned busy for women or witches or anything else.
He drops his smoke and grinds it underfoot. End of chapter 18.
Chapter 19. Test of Fates. Sham was shadowing two Thebans in the maze when a fetching harlot strolled off to work, blonde hair shining in the late day sun. Be calm. Don't chase her where everyone can see. His hair had been that blonde before he dyed it black. She passed the vulgar unicorn, heading for Triumph Gate. She'll keep till later. He was learning about whores, these cheap treats from the streets, and about the well of dark retribution in his soul. How far to push, when to wait, when to loose his passion. He was learning where to take his girls, what to do afterward if power slipped its bridle and things went too far. Whores were legion in sanctuary. An endless parade of flesh that no one valued highly. The sacred band was his obsession now, Thebans and stepsons. He would grind their leadership to dust under his heel for what they'd done to him. But not yet. Not yet. Today he hunted Thebans most of all, softer targets, still reeling from relocation. If not for the sacred band of Thebes, cowards who'd fled their fate in Chironea, no evil would have befallen Sham. He'd still be a stepson in good standing, never shamed before the greater sacred band. Those doomed Thebans ruined everything. Fleeing into the Riddler's arms instead of staying on the battle plain and dying as was their destiny. Sham had failed only one study on Bandera, and that was Mott. Once personified as a goddess, Mott, in secular Banderan lore, was the principle of balance and justice, righteousness, truth, and law, and some accursed feather which must be weighed against all a man has done. Mott made no sense to him. Why seek equilibrium when change was the engine that drove all things? But Sham now has an inkling of an imbalance to be put right. This sacred band of Thebes must surely die, here if nowhere else. They're overdue in hell. Soft voices in his mind whisper like a chorus. Nicodemus was Shamshi's ultimate target, his preordained enemy. Stealth was an adept of Mott. This one skill Sham couldn't master. The one degree of training he'd failed to attain in all those years on the Misty Isles. This elusive, cosmic justice. He would show Nico and his beloved Tempest justice in the world of men. Since none could kill the Riddler, destroying Tempest's favorite would be Sham's greatest triumph. But stealth was strong, in the world and in his mind. Too strong to try, yet. Too formidable to assault. Yet. First, to soften up his quarry, he must destroy everything prized by the Riddler and his right-side partner. Sham had just begun his reprisals. So far, he'd killed only two little-known Theban fighters, along with Ari, and wounded Lysis. He'd destroyed no heroes, no great warriors, none among the stepson leadership. Still, it had felt like fire in his blood to see his victims scramble and fall. These two Thebans he was following today, nondescript cavalrymen without a stepson escort, now turned right toward processional way, bantering intimately. One of their horses was the blue roan Sham used to ride. He wished he had it back, but he couldn't keep it, even if he killed both Thebans to get the horse. He'd had to trade his stolen sacred band horses for a less identifiable mount and money. Two Thebans on patrol. No stepson nanny with them. Meant that Tempest was letting down his guard. Time to strike. Past time. Since he'd waylaid Lysis, Sink, Gale, and Chorus in the dark, he'd withdrawn, awaiting his moment. He'd stirred them up too much. Sham knew about getting stirred up, about losing control, about letting go all thought of the future, about letting his present and his passion overwhelm him. He'd been trying his skills on the sanctuary locals. It was like shooting carp with crossbow bolts in a shallow pond. He'd been studious, practicing, in the maze, in Shambles Cross, and in Downwind, what the stepsons had taught him. How to plan a mission. How to kill a target from hiding. Sink told his trainees, "Distance is your friend. If it's worth killing, it's worth stalking." Stealth once cautioned, while schooling him alongside Artan and Chorus. You don't want or need a reputation. Reputations are deadly. Be good at your job, but don't sign your work. This advice was much harder to follow than Sink's. Sham wanted the Riddler to know that his precious band was being stalked by one of their own, whom they'd trained and then expelled. He wanted the band to know that all his training hadn't gone to waste. He dreamed of retaliation. He craved the most succulent vengeance that hell could serve up. And he was working on it, bit by careful bit. He'd dyed his skin as well as his hair. He'd sold every piece of recognizable gear. He'd found lodging and taken a job guarding produce carts offloaded from the docks. He'd grown a respectable short beard. The job wasn't much, but he already had money. He just needed an excuse to have that money and to move around the city unremarked with weapons. Lessons from his naive days with the band still served him here in Sanctuary, where rivers swallowed practice kills and swept identity away. Sham understood discipline and self-discipline. He'd been drilled his whole life long, first by the monks of the Misty Isles and then by the best of the stepsons. Before the sacred band had taught him the greatest lesson of all, sewn him in a hideous shroud of meaty hide, and left him for the fates or gods to find and save, or cast away on fortune's shore. Trust no one. Take revenge. Take it slowly, slowly.
again and again.
Whispers cautioned him like female voices dimly heard or a sighing wind from deep within his soul. Sham savors his growing power, tending the place in his mind whence inspiration comes. Chironea. Sham is learning in this school the Riddler has made for his Theban band of lovers how to kill the unwary, the overweening, and the undeserving. Do the Riddler and Stealth think he died or fled? He hoped not. Of all the precepts learned from Critias, their intelligence chief, lying low was the hardest. But he must lull them until he couldn't bear it any longer. It is so tempting to make sure the much-vaunted sacred band of stepsons knows he can slip up on them any time, have his way with them, take away what they love most, each other. They were vulnerable because they were many. He was only one, but that one was schooled by his old mentors and new enemies, the sacred band. He'd built a mental rest place that was a replica of Chironea and more. Long spears thunking into flesh, men staggering back, impaled, howling. Darkness here was overcoming everything, eating up the light on that battle plain. In this place, where he could look through each dying eye as if the battle were today. What would the Banderan monks think of that? Of him? He sent those images of Chironea to Far Bandara, his calling card, notes from his field trip. And he sent these same images to all his intended victims, hoping to dishearten them, not knowing if he did, if they saw what he projected or not. Let the Riddler and his precious stepsons think he'd gone away. Let them think Kurus's bolts skewered him. One almost did. It had whickered past so close it holed his cloak and nearly his neck. That quarrel almost made an end to him in the dark of night. Kurus was too lucky by half. He'd hit Lysis, he knew he had, but he badly wanted to kill them all. Kurus and Lysis and Sink and Gale, who had shot at him as well. Nearly time to try again. Now he must decide on this night's entertainment. Thebans or the blonde whore, or both. He'd waited long enough. He ached to make his passion felt. He struck out for the vulgar unicorn to get a drink and then decide. If he was going to take down Thebans, he'd need his horse from the livery stable. Above it, Critias had a hidey-hole, a station where the sacred band came and went, swapping information and getting orders. So he must be careful. Notwithstanding, it titillated him to be so close to the stepsons, right under their noses. He was Bandaran. He could change the way he carried himself, the way he walked, the way he stood, the set of his shoulders, a raft of small details that make one man recognize another. He'd been busy in his bay's stall, saddling up two nights ago, when Critias and Stratton walked right by him, talking about wood and provisions. He could hardly breathe. Critias looked right at him, but there was no recognition on that face. In the gloomy stable where he and his partner went about their business. So near, He could have killed the two of them right there and then, surprised them where they stood. Walk out of the stall, pretend to trip, stab a finger into one chest and elbow into a sternum, and it's done. Death touch. Corpses walking for a few hours, just long enough to walk away. But he hadn't tried it. He wasn't ready. Yet. Wait, wait. Voices in his mind whispered, a chorus of women's voices far away. In his inner sight he could still see Crit's face and his partner's. That night they overpowered him, weapons on the ground behind them. Stratton had kneed him in the groin, and he couldn't think, couldn't recover fast enough from the pain. He'd learned all a man needed to know that night about not fighting fair, about honor held in abeyance and calculated cruelty. From those men he'd once respected above all others. Some day soon they'd know how well he'd learned his lessons. Now he needed a place to wait for the moon to rise. Inside the Unicorn, with its sawdust and its board floors and its promise of anonymity that had kept it in business all these years, he bought a beer and leaned there where he could watch the door and listen to the chatter of a dozen customers. He was a regular, but here no one asked your name. The day barman, raw-boned and swarthy, hardly looked up from his stock and his bar rags. Sham wasn't paying attention to the patrons on either side of him. He was daydreaming about going after those Thebans tonight, or another pair of fighters, or a threesome. When they reached the hill with its clean and landscaped streets, its hedges and wrought-iron gates, someone said,
"Two-thumbs, did you hear about the party next full moon? Are you invited?"
"Everybody who's anybody is."
The barkeep raised his head.
"I'm not anybody, Enos. You mean the Theban beach party? That's the palace crowd, hill folk, sacred band and that sort. Not for such as me."
Very slowly, without betraying any surprise or more than casual interest, Shamshi turns his head to face the patron, a man with a tattoo on his forehead, who seems of indeterminate age.
"Well, too bad," says the man with the tattoo. "Walgren's going. The whore mistress at Phoebe's is going. And so's Myrtus, from the Aphrodisia house. You'd think the Unicorn's owner would be invited."
"Why? Because the city guard captain and two madams are on the guest list?"
asks the barkeep sourly. Sham isn't listening any longer.
"This changes everything. He has preparations to make.
But first, he needs to get his horse and his weapons and see if he can reduce the guest list by a Theban or by a stepson, or two or more. The die is cast. In this wager with Providence, the stakes are on the table. Time to up the ante." A seer and a son of the storm god ride through sanctuary in twilight. Young heroes to be, alone on patrol, looking to make their reputations, policing vicious streets. These two have new orders, new urgency in the light of all the preparations for the fate. Find Sham, the renegade, their former friend, before he kills again. Something else is new, changed. Artin's foresight catches clearer glimpses of the future. In every vision is Kurus with his green eyes and red hair, the god Vashanka's image on the earth. Tonight, the air licks your skin like a dog. Light from adjacent buildings spills out here and there, making city streets into a game board. Bright squares and dark under the scrutiny of wagering gods. Hours ago, at the barracks stable, Kurus had said,
"Artin, I can get us a night patrol. Just us. No stepson chaperone. No minder. You can see your mother if you want. I can see Shami. Nobody needs to know. Deal?"
Thunder had murmured far away. "I haven't finished cleaning these saddles." Artin looked Kurus in the eye.
"Let them clean their own tack for a change."
More thunder, closer at hand.
"I'll go, I'll go. Just don't make it rain, please,"
Artin teased.
"All this mildew is so hard to get off."
So out went Kurus, swaggering in long strides right up to the Riddler's door. Kurus had knocked. Artin had wanted to hide. But the door had opened. Nicodemus slipped outside, said something, and inclined his head in that way of his that made you think your soul was on display. A moment later, stealth was gone, and Kurus was jogging back across the courtyard to Artin. Now here they were on two experienced war horses, crossbows hanging from their saddles, prowling city streets. They hadn't completely mastered the skill of firing crossbows from horseback, but they'd had some practice, or Kurus had. Artin hoped he didn't have to shoot his. Crossbows in the night were tricky. Artin's foresight was restless. He kept imagining what it would be like to have your crossbow trained on these shadows, like Kurus and Lysis had done when they'd been ambushed with Sink and Gale. Their close call was still the talk of the barracks. He was jittery, probably not seeing the future, just his own worries. Their mounts walked side by side up processional way, the widest street leading to the palace.
"I was there," Kurus told him, pointing up the street. "In the palace. Don't say I told you."
"Has it got anything to do with how we got this duty?"
"Maybe."
Kurus dropped his reins and crossed his arms, showing off his horsemanship.
"Fine, don't tell me. This patrol better not be trouble. My foresight doesn't like it out here tonight."
Best remind Kurus that Artin is now recognized for his own special skill. The long twilight paints the city walls with blue and crimson. Deep purple shadows spill off the palace dome. For a moment, the skyline of Sanctuary is almost beautiful. At the north end of processional, where they should turn left on Governor's Walk, to go to the bazaar where Artin's mother was, or to the Red Lantern's district where Shomi the prostitute could be found, Kurus turned his horse to the right instead. Blocked, Artin's mount turned too.
"I thought we were going to Illyris."
"Let's just patrol first. We have to do our jobs. Who knows what we'll find up on the hill?" The voice of the storm god's son was purposely portentous.
"Honor, glory, women!"
Not far up the road, where you bear left at Promise of Heaven Park, they heard shouting. Their helmets were hooked on their saddles off sides, crossbows on the near sides. Kurus grinned at him and clucked to his mount.
"See, I can see the future, too."
Artin's horse leaps forward. Then they're running down the middle of the street toward the commotion. Pedestrians scatter. Men shake fists. Women squeal and hike up their skirts, scrambling off the street to safety. Artin couldn't get his helmet on and his crossbow in position while his horse was galloping under him. Corus had his short sword in hand. It caught the light, gleaming. "Get your throwing stars," yelled the son of the storm god. They still couldn't see the fight, if fight it was, around the blind corner ahead. Then two horses came thundering round that corner, straight at them, riderless and wild-eyed. When horses have that look, they don't stop. The runaways parted Artin and Corus's horses and kept running, thundering by. They both saw the sacred band gear on the runaways. Corus raised his hand and they reined down to a walk. All around, shadows were deepening. The shouting had stopped. Their horses blew and jigged. Artin's blood pounded in his ears. He hissed, "I told you so!" His horse didn't want to walk. It spun around and around. It wanted to chase the other two, running pell-mell home to their barrack stalls. Maybe his mount was right and they should recover the bolting horses, but somewhere up ahead were the stepsons to whom those horses belonged. He struggled with his mount. It danced and fussed. He slapped it on the neck hard. "I said something wasn't right." He pulled on his reins, slapping the bay again, but it wouldn't quiet down. "No, you didn't. Tell me what your foresight says right now." Chorus's voice was brusque, one hand upraised in the stepson's caution sign. Chorus peered all around, left, right, up, into the tricky light and down the manicured street. "It says watch your back and mine," Artin retorted, finally getting horse calm and crossbow ready. "Careful," Corus warns. Then he whispers,
"Whatever was happening, maybe it's not over."
Artin peers into the light and shadow, looking where Corus is looking. His horse goes where Chorus's goes. It's a relief to point his horse's face into Chorus's mount's tail, so the beast will settle down. But it's a war horse, and it doesn't stay settled long. He needs both hands on his reins. It's heard action, and it wants to join the fray. In a dozen strides, Artin sees a crowd forming around two men with Theban panoplies lying in the street. Those Theban breastplates are unmistakable. Artin's horse had heard the fight, smelled the blood, known better than he and Chorus what was happening. Artin's fingers are clumsy, holding too much. Reins, throwing stars, crossbow. They slide off their mounts and drop their reins. Artin shoulders his bow. He and Chorus draw their swords, brandishing them at the twilight. Striding over to the knot of well-dressed folk, Chorus orders,
"Make way! Make way! Sacred band business!"
Chorus barges through the gathering crowd, disappearing as it closes in his wake.
"Business that would have been better served if you'd been here earlier," grouses some anonymous critic from the middle of the throng.
Clatter echoes down the street, hooves pounding, closer, closer. Then shouts, maneuver codes, all the sounds of cavalry approaching fast.
"Let's go, people. There's nothing to see here,"
comes a sharp, commanding voice from an armored man in a helmet, riding up and sliding to a stop. with the sounds of more horses close behind him. "Clear out, you. We don't need more targets where danger might still be. Get out of range before you're next." In a flurry of clamors, the lanky steps up.